Oyez, oyez, oyez. The Honorable Supreme Court of Texas is now in session pursuant to adjournment.
Thank you. Be seated. Today, the court has four matters on its oral submission docket. In the order in which they will be presented, they are as follows. General Motors Corporation, Tommy Dollar and others, versus Clyde Broyed, Ron Godby, and Regina Godby from Harrison County. Clara DeWitt and others versus Harris County from Harris County. Robert Tilton and others versus the Honorable John McClellan Marshall, an original mandamus proceeding. And Temple Independent School District versus George English from Travis County. In the first call, the court has allotted 30 minutes for each side to present oral argument. In the remaining three, the court has allotted 20 minutes for each side to present oral argument. We will take a brief recess in between the first and second and the second and third arguments, then take a lunch break and reconvene at 2 o'clock for the final argument. These arguments are being recorded by the clerk's office for the convenience of the court and for a nominal fee. Anyone may make application with our clerk for a copy of the tape. Certain of these arguments are also being filmed audio-visually. The court is now ready to hear argument from petitioner in General Motors versus Royer.
Chief Justice, may it please the court, Larry York and Judge Joe Greenhill for the appellate class in this case. This case involved a settlement involving 650,000 or thereabouts Texas GM Chevrolet truck owners. In addition to the class, those appearing or those in support of this settlement are the Texas Association of Defense Counsel, the State of Texas, Texas Trial Lawyers Association, in a rare joint appearance with the Texas Association of Defense Counsel. Those and General Motors, of course. Those appearing to oppose are two, one former owner of a truck that was affected by the class, and one person who I believe still owns one of those trucks. Ralph Nader's opposed, and the lawyers on the other side of the table are opposed. They have a competing class that they have filed in federal court in Dallas to take over this class if we lose and charge contingent fees if we lose. About 0.1% of the persons in the $650,000 member class objected to the class settlement. About 2.2%, 1,100 or so, opted out. Before the court today is 0.0005% of the class here objecting. This is not, may it please the court, the tail wagging the dog. It is the last hair on the tail of the dog wagging or attempting to wag the dog.
Mr. York, let me be sure I understand the nature of this class. There are 650,000 individuals.
Yes. 650,000 trucks.
650,000 trucks.
Yes, sir.
So as far as individual members of the class, it doesn't reach that number. Now, does that include fleet?
Yes. The state of Texas is the largest fleet owner in the state, I believe, and they have something over 3,000 trucks, and they've joined in supporting these.
So we can think about people. How many people are we talking about in that 650,000?
Well, I've seen some numbers that, you know, in an average household, maybe there's 1.8 people or 2 people or something, but it's a larger group, obviously, than 650,000, because that'd be it.
Oh, you're saying that the truck owner's family is represented. I'm talking about individual owners.
650,000. Well, I'm sorry, we're talking about different things. There's 650,000. I can't tell you exactly how many of those are fleets. There's nobody in this objecting who is a fleet owner. But there's some part of that group that is owned by fleets.
And how many trucks are in the corresponding litigation in the federal district court class action?
In Pennsylvania, there are about roughly $5 million, I believe, $6 million, roughly. Judge Cook and I will divide our time about 10 minutes. I'm going to talk a lot more about attorney's fees. He will talk more about the settlement, but I need to talk a little bit about the settlement because the Court of Appeals' view of the case was that the attorney's fees had no value because the settlement had no value. And that's what I need to address the settlement a bit in order to make that point.
Just a little bit of background. Now, I understand it's undisputed that any personal injuries, bodily injuries, are not a part of this litigation.
Yes, sir.
This is strictly litigation involving people who bought the cars and claimed the cars were not the value that they represented to be.
Yes, sir. There's a handout that we have handed. It's the one with a beige sort of cover on it that outlines the settlement agreement, and there's also a handout in there about what the Court of Appeals did. And that settlement, that agreement, Judge, makes clear that personal injury and death are excluded, whether past or future, and any action by the national authorities, NHTSA as it's called for short, are excluded. The abuse standard that this court had to judge, the Court of Appeals had to judge the trial court's action on, is an abuse of discretion standard. There are numerous cases, and I won't bother talking about the standards, where they talk about you have to decide the court acted without reference to any guiding principle. Cases say an abuse of discretion doesn't exist where the trial court bases its decision on conflicting evidence, as this one did. This court went over the Ball factors at the trial level. Findings of fact and conclusions indicate they made exactly the analysis that is required and compelled by the appellate courts, and came out approving the settlement. Now, if you read the handout that we gave that sets out the factors as they were considered, the six factors considered by the appellate court, if you read those as we did, I was confused when I first read the Court of Appeals opinion because it appeared to me that they were about to affirm what the trial court had done. If you read those six factors, everything they say about those six factors is in favor of finding four. So it appears that it was almost like written by committee. That one group said, somebody wrote it and said, we're going to affirm, and you get to a certain point, and then it says, but we're going to submit our judgment, suggestion, to replace the trial court's judgment. When you read what they actually say, it's clear that they replaced the trial court's judgment with theirs. They say it's questionable that the $6,000 certificates have any value. They say it's questionable whether the $500 certificates have any value. They say a settlement requiring GM to pay for all class members' repairs would be more comforting. And they're talking about the trial court having made an error in judgment when they talk that way. And that is what the appellate court cannot do. It cannot be a trial de novo if we're to continue to have our rules as we've had them forever in this state. On the subject of attorney's fees, first of all, percentage fees are standard in these kinds of cases in Texas. There was absolutely no evidence. No one suggests Topside or Bottler that the appellate court found, and there's no evidence of any collusion or fraud between the defendant and the class.
What's the value of the settlement against which that percentage might be applied?
The trial judge found that a $9 million attorney's fee represented less than 10% of the settlement.
Can you suggest to us how that can be calculated?
Well, the way it's calculated is you look at the evidence before the court. If you remember, the evidence before the trial court was in the form of affidavits. An affidavit from a man named Nichols and an affidavit from a man named Simons. And those affidavits, they had actually polled the class. Simonson polled the class nationally, and Nichols polled the class in Texas and concluded that some 45% to 50% of those in the class would utilize the certificates. Now,
is it true that Nichols' poll is based on a survey of 109 class members?
Yes, that's true.
And that's the only evidence of the 46%.
No, Simonson reaches the same conclusion in a national poll that had validity for Texas. And so, if you look at those numbers, $645,000, if they all used a the whole group used a $1,000 certificate, you'd come up with a $650 million value. If 45%, you'd get $300 million. If it were less than that, it's $200 million. The trial judge concluded that when she said less than 10%, that would calculate to being that the value had to be more than 90%, more than $90 million. In fact, if you would come down as far as $30 million in value and compare a $9 million fee to that, you would find that it was 30%, and 30% is at the top of the 20 to 30% range that has been approved repeatedly by courts in this state.
Why isn't it troublesome that in the national MDL litigation, only slightly more attorney's fees were requested and rewarded by substantially more lawyers in a substantially bigger case?
I don't think it's troublesome because they have a different standard in the Third Circuit. They use what is called the Lodestar standard in the Third Circuit that is mandated by a law in the Third Circuit. It is not one which we have in this state. It's simply a different standard. Theirs is more close to an hourly rate, and that is one that I believe is being retreated from by other circuits and by states.
So
but it's not one we have in this state.
Assertion in the brief that this attorney's fee request comes out about $1,500 an hour. Do you dispute that?
No. But in Crouch versus Tenneco, one of the leading cases in this area, it came out to $3,000 an hour. I mean, they come out to multiples of a reasonable hourly rate every time in a contingent fee case, because for those kinds of cases and those lawyers, it's chicken one day and feathers the next.
There's an assertion in the amicus brief of the Public Citizen and Consumer Federation that the only reason to bring this action separately in Texas and not to join the MDL litigation was so that the attorney's fees would be bigger in this case. What's the response to that?
Well, the response to that is that we started this case before we knew what was going on, or the class counsel did. They started the case in state court, which is where they wanted to be. They had doubts about the Moss-Magnuson jurisdiction in federal court. They had doubts about Lanham Act jurisdiction. They had a bunch of cases that were smaller than $50,000 each, and they had a concern about jurisdiction in federal court for that reason. And they did not want to be burdened. In this case, moved faster than the federal court case. This case, in fact, drove the federal court case. They did not want to be impeded by and be part of a nightmarish MDL proceeding in Philadelphia, Pennsylvania. And I think to the interest of the class, they weren't.
In calculating a percentage fee, if that's an acceptable method of awarding a fee in this case, should the finder of fact take into account the lack of any other available discounts that a purchaser could use in order to decide if this $1,000 was really $1,000 or if it was less than that?
I think the trial court took that into account. If $1,000, and my time is up, I need to sit down, but if $1,000 per truck was used, it's $650 million. Surely nobody could argue with that. The evidence was that it was worth less than that.
But do you have to look at what other discounts were ordinarily and normally available on various dealer and manufacturer incentives?
No, not at all. $1,000 is on top of all of them. If you walk into one of those $1,000 deals, you get that on top of every other single discount or program, whatever the dealer's got, that $1,000 goes on top of all of them.
Was there any study about how many additional trucks General Motors could anticipate to sell because of this incentive that they would not have otherwise sold, and what type of profit there would be on those sales even with a $1,000 discount?
Well, the evidence was that 77% of GM truck owners are going to buy another GM truck. So GM is not expecting a sales bonanza as a result of this promotion.
But not within any 15-month period.
No, I mean, right.
I mean, there might be an acceleration even if that statistic.
Well, there could be an acceleration, but I think their idea is if they don't plan to sell more trucks as a result of this, and in any event, let me just make this point that no case anywhere has ever suggested that we've seen, except this case, that harm or pain to the defendant is a necessary ingredient to approving the settlement. By the plaintiff's definition, if they used every one of the 645,000 certificates, GM would make a huge bonanza, but it would be worth $645 million to the class, a huge bonanza to the class, and a tiny fee in comparison.
Any other questions? Thank you, Counselor.
No.
May it please this honorable court, with me at counsel, Mr. Lee Shetson, attorney with General Motors. I'd like to give you a few brief sentences from a recent announcement from the United States Department of Transportation Office of the Secretary, Federico Pena. As Secretary of Transportation, I have no greater responsibility than to protect and improve the safety of the traveling public. This settlement will save far more lives than could ever have been saved by the proceeding with the other options I had before me. The alternatives were to proceed with a recall that would have involved years of litigation and uncertain outcome and prevented few, if any, deaths. This settlement I am announcing today is a common sense outcome and a victory for safety and saving lives. There will be no national recall of Chevrolet and General Motors trucks. I would like to now take time with the court to tell you why this is a good settlement for the plaintiffs. First of all, the plaintiffs have suffered no economic harm, despite all the bad publicity from certain elements of the media. The value of these trucks, of these used trucks, never went down. It kept up with Ford and with Chrysler. There is no economic loss whatsoever. Second, we've already talked about if you have a personal injury or a death action, you're not excluded by being part of this action. Two important reasons. Third, another reason why this is a good settlement. Nearly all of the plaintiffs would have been time barred by limitations. Remember, these trucks go back to 1973 and come forward to 1991. Starting in 1973, General Motors advertised in its advertising that these trucks had gas tanks mounted outside the frames. The truth is, there are no defects in these trucks. There's been a lot of publicity about this, but the fact is there's 3 million trucks on the highway, medium and heavy-duty trucks. These are light-duty trucks that have gas tanks in the same position. GM would fight any formal certification of a class, and GM would have a good chance of prevailing. What we have here is a product that has no defects, where the owner of the product is not having any problems with that product.
Mr. Cook, why did GM agree to settle a case worth $300 million.
GM used the same six factors that the trial court did and looked at those factors, the six factors involved, and this is a compromise settlement of a disputed claim by which General Motors is hopefully forever buying its peace. And the trial court looked at these factors and came to the conclusion this was a good settlement and a reasonable settlement. Court of Appeals, we believe, is wrong. Let me take just a few seconds to address the question of attorney's fees. This is a large case. It is a large class. It is a significant settlement in terms of value. It is the largest rebate settlement in the history of General Motors, ever. Counsel for the plaintiffs are excellent. Franklin Jones is known to this court as a very able plaintiff's lawyer, a former president of the State Bar. Considering all the factors, all six factors in this case, General Motors made the conscious decision that it did not warrant objection to the attorney's fees.
Why shouldn't the members of the class have been advised of the amount of the attorney's fees during the period of time when they were allowed to lodge objections?
That's a valid question. When the case was settled, the attorney's fees were not. The case law is real clear in Texas, for instance, the Chabay case, that since when they settled the case, attorney's fees had not been resolved, you could not send out notice to the class of what the attorney's fees were going to be.
Was there any reason why they couldn't be resolved?
They simply had not been resolved. And from General Motors' point of view, General Motors does not get involved with the plaintiffs to determine what a reasonable fee should be.
Where did the $9 million figure come from?
The $9 million figure was the number that was arrived at by the plaintiffs. They submitted it to the, then there were 20 days notice in which anyone could object. And the objectors did object during that 20-day period. But when the case was settled, there was no agreement on attorney's fees. If General Motors would have reached an agreement on attorney's fees and become involved in that, they then would have been accused of being in a conspiracy.
Well, how can the class know whether to object to the settlement without knowing the amount of the attorney's fees? Because the argument is that if there hadn't been such a high amount of attorney's fees awarded under the settlement, that the benefits class members could have been enhanced, perhaps by making these vouchers negotiable or some other way to increase the value to the class members.
You can make that argument.
Why isn't that right?
Why isn't it right? The attorney's fees did not come out of the settlement amount. That was reached independently by the parties, the exact details of the settlement. The plaintiffs then said, we will apply for our attorney's fees. General Motors reserved several rights, one of which was to veto the entire settlement, the other was to object, and the third was to appeal to these attorney's fees. The procedure that has been used here is widely used. If you look at the Manual of Complex Litigation, it sets out several different types of forms. One of the forms follows the procedure that was used here. If you look at Newberg's on class actions, it has several forms. One of the forms is the one that's very similar to what was used here.
It just looks like a party would feel a little nervous knowing that his attorney is being paid by his opponent to settle the case. Why doesn't that raise problems?
It does raise problems with certain people, but this is a procedure that has been adopted and used very widely in this country. It is a procedure. You need to look at all six factors to determine are the attorney's fees reasonable.
How long after the settlement of the main case was announced did they resolve the issue of attorney's fees?
The case was settled on, I believe, July 19th. The attorney's fees application was filed, I believe, about October, beginning of October.
And then it was filed, and then when was it resolved?
It was resolved at a fairness hearing, at which time the court went over everything in the case.
In October?
Yes.
Isn't it a little troubling that even the parties advocating this settlement, experts estimated that over half of the class would not take advantage of this settlement?
First of all, nothing prevents anyone from taking advantage of the settlement. This is, they're saying, we estimate this percentage will take advantage of it. If you go to Newberg on class actions, you will find there are numerous class actions which have been approved where the percentage of acceptance was much, much lower than those in this particular case. If you will look at this chart for judgment, Mr. Chief Justice.
Well, Mr. York mentioned earlier in answer to one of my questions that the $1,000 certificate could be used on top of any other discount.
That is correct.
There was a sales provision. You could negotiate one of these certificates outside a member of your immediate family, but it was only worth $500.
Right, if it's outside.
Outside the immediate family. And those certificates could not be used in conjunction with any other manufacturer's promotional opportunity. Isn't that correct?
Yes.
Which, I don't know if there, I didn't see any specific findings on that, but it would be very unlikely that that type of certificate would have much market value. Is that correct?
No. It is estimated from some of the people who are experts that there will be a secondary class market for these certificates and that they will be sold and there will be a market for them.
Your time has expired. Are there any other questions?
Wouldn't you agree that the $9 million in attorney's fees awarded versus the amount of the vouchers awarded from the settlement at least raises the potential for a conflict of interest between the attorneys and the class members?
Whenever you have an attorney getting attorney's fees in a class action lawsuit, you always have the potential for a conflict of interest.
If that's true, then why wouldn't the Lodestar method be a more appropriate means for resolving the issue of attorney's fees here, where there is some factoring into, taking into account the number of hours spent, and then some perhaps bonus paid above a normal hourly rate for the difficulty of the case and the other factors that ordinarily go into.
The Lodestar method is used by certain jurisdictions. In other jurisdictions, the percentage method is widely favored. In this particular case, the attorneys have the case on a contingent fee method. But there is a tremendous amount of literature which gives you the range of fees based on the amount in controversy. There is a class action reported where I studied over 400 class actions that were settled, and it gave you the range of fees that were allowed based upon the amount in controversy. So the amount of literature is, there's a lot of it out there. That's why you have, there's a case called Ace Heating, and it says the trial judge is on the firing line. And he really is, and he's the one out there who determines whether it should be approved. And quoting this court in Walker versus Packer, with respect to the resolution of factual issues or matters committed to the trial court's discretion, the reviewing court may not substitute its judgment for that of the trial court. And what you have here, this is where they went wrong. A more fair and reasonable settlement would be. This is where the Court of Appeals put on the mantle of the trial judge, and instead of the abuse of discretion standard, went back and used the de novo standard for determining what they would like.
Any other questions? Thank you, counsel. The court is ready to hear argument from respondents.
May it please the court, Mr. Stephen Gardner and Mr. Roger L. Mandel present argument for the respondents. Mr. Stephen Gardner will present the first 18 minutes.
May it please the court. I represent Ron and Regina Godby, two GM truck owners who objected to the class settlement. Today, I will discuss the reasons why the Court of Appeals correctly found that the trial court had abused its discretion when it approved the settlement. With me today is Roger Mandel, who will discuss the attorney's fees issues before this court. On the merits of the settlement, the objective position is simple. The trial court abused its discretion because it failed in its duty to make an independent determination that the settlement was fair, adequate, and reasonable to the class as a whole. In support of this position, I want to make two points to the court today. First, although class actions are a good and efficient means of resolving disputes, this settlement is an abuse of the class action process. And secondly, the trial court so fundamentally failed in its responsibility to the absent class members that its approval of the settlement was in fact an abuse of discretion. If the court will permit me a few moments to put this settlement into the context of what this lawsuit was about when it was filed. This lawsuit, when filed, was based on the worst vehicle fire safety hazard in history, exploding side saddle gas truck tanks in General Motors trucks that killed more than 400 people and badly injured over 2,000 more. The trucks are flawed by a dangerous and latent design defect, the placement of the gas tanks outside the frame rails.
Do you, Mr. Garner, do you agree, though, that the only issue involved in this one is the only tangible damages involved in this litigation is economic damage?
Yes, Your Honor, very much so. But what is
all... So, is it, so in terms of evaluating the settlement issue, is it relevant that there are fiery crashes with the
truck? Yes, Your Honor, to a degree that Judge Cook referred to GM's desire to buy its piece. In fact, by merely passing on these trucks to a new generation of truck owners, GM is not buying its piece at all. It is merely settling this lawsuit.
But
because,
if, in terms of the evaluation of the settlement, the only issue here is the economic damages suffered by the class. I believe Mr. Cook has said that there is no evidence of any economic damages to the class.
I would have to differ with Judge Cook on that. There is evidence that of economic damage, not for diminution of value, which the plaintiffs and GM have latched onto because apparently the Blue Book value has not diminished. there is either evidence or could easily be developed evidence for the second standard that this court has determined is available at the option of the plaintiffs in a Deceptive Trade Practices Act case, which is the cost of repair of the trucks. There is evidence before the court on the cost of repair. That well serves as a the indication of the economic damage of the class members.
Is it, could it be that a reasonable analysis of this would be if a party felt that the cost to them of repairing the truck because they want it, or the diminution in value of the truck for resale is, I guess, less than $1,000 on a trade-in, that economically it would be in their benefit to trade the truck in as opposed to trying to sell it?
And certainly, Your Honor, yes. And certainly some class members may opt to do that. We know from the evidence that the plaintiffs and GM presented, the Simonson and the Nichols affidavits, that under the best, most optimistic, and we believe fundamentally flawed estimates, less than half of the class will get that will be able to take advantage of that opportunity. They may not want to go back to GM. They may feel that GM sold them a dangerous truck, and they may, because this is America, not choose to do business again with the people who sold them a dangerous product. They may simply not be able to afford it. Most of these trucks were used trucks and were bought used by people who I don't believe opted to buy used trucks, but rather would have preferred to buy a new truck had they been financially able to. About 90% plus of these trucks right now are over 8 years old. These are old trucks, they're diminishing in value, and people do not have who bought them did not have largely the wherewithal to buy a new truck. The only thing this settlement gives the minority of the class members who, according to the plaintiffs and GM, would use the coupons is the opportunity to buy a new truck, to provide, I believe there's evidence before the court, approximately $2,000 per truck in profit to General Motors, and do so within a 15-month period.
Do I understand your argument correctly that if the plaintiffs had represented this class pro bono and had taken no dollars in fees, you would still be challenging this settlement as unreasonable and saying that the Court of Appeals was correct in disturbing the judgment of the trial court, that this was fair and adequate?
Absolutely, Your Honor. The excessiveness of the attorney's fees, as Mr. Mandel will discuss, is not pudding. It may be the proof of the pudding, but it is not the only evidence of problems. The true problem here is...
you make a very good case for the strength of your argument, but can't General Motors also make a very good case that had this litigation gone to a verdict and judgment, that the plaintiffs would have taken nothing? And isn't that the kind of factual disparity that parties are allowed to resolve through settlement?
To a degree, parties are, any case is best often resolved by settlement. Most cases do resolve by settlement. Most class actions do resolve by settlement. But when you have parties in the courtroom, the plaintiff's lawyers, GM's lawyers, coming before the trial court saying, we like this settlement, it's an out-of-the-average settlement. It is something that Rule 42, as far as I can tell, places a unique duty onto the trial court to examine the settlement. This is not just a resolution of dispute between private parties. This is a resolution of a dispute that in this case affects hundreds and hundreds of thousands of people, and their interests must also be taken into account.
So how would you articulate the standard that a trial court is to use, and then, more importantly, that an appellate court uses in reviewing that trial court decision?
In this particular case, I think that certificate settlements are on the rise. I believe that they are evidence of an abuse overall of the settlement, of the class action settlement process. They generally give more in reward to the class lawyers than to the class members. We have suggested in our brief that this court could set a very clear standard that no class action may be settled without by certificates that does not also contain a significant cash component that might be, as some of the coupon settlements in other cases have done, by giving class members the alternative of cashing in for a reduced amount, whereby they could get, instead of the $1,000 coupon, they could elect $500. I believe that's the value that General Motors put on this settlement today, works out at $300 million to approximately $500 per individual. If, in fact, it is worth that much, then that dollar amount should be there so that we're playing with real dollars and not the funny money coupon.
If there were no realistic chance of plaintiffs prevailing in the case, wouldn't certificates or some settlement like this be appropriate?
No, Your Honor, it wouldn't, because if the plaintiffs are going to lose, the system should be allowed to work and they ought to lose. We think the plaintiffs will win. We think they have a very good case.
But plaintiffs can settle even if they think they're going to lose.
They can.
And defendants can choose to give them whatever, if it's nothing more than saving face, is appropriate to get them to go away. Why can't they do that here?
Because it does not give relief to the members of the class. Over half
but that
the
assumes
class.
That they're entitled to any. They may not be entitled to any.
With all respect, Your Honor, I don't think it requires that assumption in a settlement. It is the fundamental test that the settlement must be fair, adequate, and reasonable to the members of the class as a whole, not to some subset, and not presuming that they're going to lose.
But assume the case is tried and they do lose. They'd have been better off with the settlement.
Some will have, some will not have.
But overall, something is better than nothing.
Your Honor, I would differ with that. I think that if this is a loser, the process should work out, and there should not be a windfall to anyone.
That's a hard rule to apply in other cases, because there are a lot of cases where it looks as if one side or the other is going to lose, and that's all the more reason to settle. You can.
Those cases, by and large, Your Honor, are individual cases. They do not have the special guardianship of the absent class members that Rule 42 puts onto the trial court. It does not have the dozens or hundreds, or in this case, hundreds of thousands of people who are unrepresented and not before the court.
Why don't we say that an individual who chooses to sue GM on a thin liability case should be able to make a nuisance settlement, but a large class should not, that they should either have to substantially prevail or lose everything?
Neither one should happen, Your Honor. The fact is that there are nuisance settlements, but the fact also is that there are nuisance class actions. I have seen them. I have seen other actions that have been brought after the resolution was a fait accompli, where nothing was sought but attorney's fees. This is a growing phenomenon. It is an abuse of the class action process. In this instance, the class action process, the system worked. The Court of Appeals fulfilling its mandate to review the trial court's actions by an abuse of discretion standard said a fairly bright line standard, and that when less than half of the class get any relief, and that relief is itself speculative, but get any relief whatsoever, as a matter of law, that settlement must fail. Well, we would propose to this court as a standard for settlements is that in order to be fair, adequate, and reasonable to the class as a whole, not to the parties in the court, not to the class counsel, not to the defendant, the settlement relief must be available to all or virtually all of the members of the class.
Has any court ever announced such a standard in class action review?
The only court that has announced anything similar to that was the district court in Minnesota in the Boucher versus ITT case that I believe all parties have cited in their briefs. That court holding, in a holding that almost presaged what the Court of Appeals did here, said that a settlement that provided relief to less than half of the class was not acceptable. That court also said that the fact that the defendant there was unwilling to provide any cash component to the settlement betokened that defendant's determination that the settlement was not really worth what it was representing it to the court to be. The Court of Appeals agreed with the Boucher logic in general and in specific and said that it doubted that GM really placed the value of The $500 you've heard today, I figured it to be $321 based on some other numbers that were presented in the briefs. Those are not real numbers. Those are numbers that are manufactured to justify the settlement, but they cannot do so because to over half the class, they don't get $500, they don't get $1,000, they don't get 1 cent. They get zero. They get absolutely no relief whatsoever.
Why?
Because, for a variety of reasons, as I said earlier, because they choose not to, or
they cannot choose not to. Now, don't they have the right to, if I walk up and hand somebody a $10 bill, they say, I don't want your $10 bill, that's fine. They have the right to say that they don't want it.
They have the right to refuse to return to GM. It is anomalous within our system to say, in order to receive any recompense for what this alleged wrongdoer did to you, you must go give them new business and new profit. They have that right to do that. But more importantly, most of the people, it's not a matter of right, it's a matter of choice. They don't choose to be poor. They don't choose to be middle class. They do not simply have the opportunity to buy a brand new truck, average purchase price of $20,000 within the brief 15-month window that this settlement provides. It's not a matter of choice at all.
Different because a majority of the class, in fact, an overwhelming majority, were absolutely ineligible to participate in the settlement rather than here where it's just an estimate that they won't be able to participate. I mean, theoretically, everybody could participate in this settlement if they all won the lottery or all mortgaged their house or whatever.
It's one of those if ifs and buts for candy and nuts, we don't have a merry holiday.
But isn't that a distinction? I mean, wouldn't we be the first court to say just based on estimates?
Well, that's part of the problem. It's really not the objective problem. The estimates, Your Honor, are the only evidence the trial court had, the court of appeals had, or this court had, that this settlement has any value whatsoever to anyone. We are spotting the plaintiffs and GM, the 46% estimate. There are other reports that one of the GM lawyers publicly stated that it was probably could possibly go down to single-digit redemption. We presented evidence that speculated redemption around 10%. But we are spotting them, this bare majority of the class who gets nothing. But assuming even the best case analysis, and we can do nothing more than project in this matter, assuming all of that, they get absolutely nothing.
Carter, I think you've taken most of your full conference time.
I think I have, really. Pardon me, there are no further
questions. Just ask one question. I believe it was Mr. York who said that in no other case, other than the Court of Appeals decision here, has the court taken into account the benefit here to GM from the purchase of new vehicles. In other words, the Court of Appeals was concerned that built into this was a $2,000 profit on all the new vehicles that GM would potentially sell under the settlement. Are you, do you dispute that characterization?
I do not, Your Honor. I have not looked for that. I am aware of none where, in the language of the opinion, the court made that discussion. I do agree that it's a valid point to look at in terms of trying to arrive at what the economic value of the settlement, the true economic value to the defendant is.
Any other questions? Thank you, counsel.
Thank you. May it please the court. My name is Roger Mandel. Along with my co-counsel Mark Stanley, I represent respondent Clyde Lloyd. As Mr. Gardner indicated, I will be addressing the attorney fees issue today. More specifically, I'll make two arguments. First, we'll argue that the Court of Appeals correctly held that the approval of the settlement was an abuse of discretion, because the class notice failed to disclose either the exact amount or a maximum amount of attorney fees and expenses sought by class counsel. Second, we'll argue that the Court of Appeals correctly held that there was insufficient evidence to support an attorney fees award of $9.5 million, such that the approval of the settlement by the trial court was an abuse of discretion.
Before you begin, let me ask you if any of those issues are involved in the appeal of the MDL action.
Your Honor, it is my understanding that the attorney's fees issue was somehow handled separately in the MDL litigation, and some of the people on appeal are trying to bring it up for on appeal, bring up the attorney's fees issue for the first time on appeal. So there may be an argument in that case that the attorney's fees issue was not preserved for appeal, unlike the present case.
And secondly, counsel alluded earlier to another suit that has been filed in the United States District Court for the Northern District of Texas. What case is that?
Your Honor, there's a case called Crowder versus GM that was brought by the same attorneys that are here before you today. The purpose of that suit was to take care of the many people who are buying trucks after the July 19th deadline. This settlement said that if you own a truck on July 19th, you're in the class, and if you buy one of these dangerous trucks after that, you're not on the settlement. There was evidence presented that as many as 10,000 of these trucks are sold a month. So in essence, we have another group of hundreds of thousands of people who own these potentially fatal trucks who are not taken care of by this settlement. And the goal of filing the other suit was to take care of these other people who are exposed to the trucks and people who may be involved in crashes with these trucks. What the court has to keep in mind is the animating principle of this lawsuit originally is brought by plaintiff attorneys, quite properly, was to try to remedy these defects to get this truck fixed. Once the carrot of $9 million in attorney's fees was dangled, however, they amended their petition to drop that kind of relief and to only ask for coupons or monetary damages. What's crucial to remember in this case is that class counsel owed a fiduciary duty to all the members of the class. This has been consistently held by the federal courts. Greenfield versus Villager Industries, the Third Circuit opinion in 73 is a good example. It's been black letter Texas law for decades that the attorney-client relationship is a fiduciary relationship.
Mr. Mandel, let me ask you, the notice to the claimants about their objection indicated that the size of the settlement would not be affected by the attorney's fees. So no matter what was awarded as attorney's fees, the amount paid in settlement wasn't going to change.
Well, Your Honor, I think as an economic matter, that is simply a fiction. The amount of the settlement is the entire amount payable by the defendant, GM in this case. And what the class members have a right to know is, how is the entire amount payable by GM going to be split up between class counsel and the members of the class so that the class members can make an intelligent judgment as to whether they want to opt out of the settlement or whether they want to object to the settlement?
Let's go back to that. If the amount of the settlement that's available is not going to be affected by the amount of the attorney's fees, then your argument is, well, they've got to know whether or not these plaintiffs sold me out. That's what you're saying. You're entitled to know whether or not they sold us out.
Well, I think certainly they're entitled to know whether they were sold out, but it goes beyond that. GM was willing to do whatever the certificates will cost them and to pay $9.5 million in fees. The question is, and $9.5 million in cash, the question is, should it have been certificates and $10 or $15 cash per person and much less in attorney's fees? In other words, should part or all of that $9.5 million more properly have been paid by GM, which was willing to pay it, to the members of the class? And the class members have the right to know what the distribution of the total amount payable by GM is so that they can make an intelligent judgment as to how they would proceed from there.
So the statement is incorrect. The statement to the members that the amount of the settlement is not going to be affected by what is paying attorney's fees is an incorrect statement.
Absolutely, Your Honor. That is a economic fiction that they tried to perpetrate upon the class, and they have consistently done in the Court of Appeals. And here, as a matter of economics, it's simply an untruth. And the Court of Appeals saw through this argument and said very clearly in its opinion that what you have to look at is the total amount of the settlement, and the distribution needs to be disclosed. And that necessarily arises out of the fiduciary duty. In fact, it was obligated on these counsel by the Texas Disciplinary Rules of Professional Conduct, 1.02 and 1.03, as the Court of Appeals stated.
Now, are you saying, Mr. Mandel, that the actual $9 million was negotiated prior to the settlement?
Your Honor, we were not allowed to do discovery, and we very much wanted to do discovery into this issue, so we weren't able to develop that evidence. But I don't think that is ultimately the point. The ultimate point.
You're implying, though, that it was, that they knew how much it was going to cost altogether when they agreed. When General Motors agreed, that they knew about how much it was going to cost to settle.
We are
an attorney's fee.
Your Honor, I think it's important to look at it from the perspective of the plaintiff's counsel. The issue is, could they and should they, at the time they gave the notice, have disclosed either the exact amount or a maximum amount of fees? Now, you look at the timing here, and it is incredibly suspicious. They send out the class notice in August of 1993. The class notice sets as the deadline for either opting or objecting to the settlement October 5th, 1993. 2 days later, 2 days after the information could have been useful to the members of the class, they file their fee application on October 7th, 1993, only 2.5 weeks before the October 27th fairness hearing. The timing was specifically, just on its face, was done so as to prevent the class from finding out how much they were going to ask, knowing that, of course, it was that people were going to say, I get a certificate, which is virtually worthless to me, and on the other hand, they get $9.5 million in cash.
Mr. Hendel, let me ask you this question. Is your objection to the amount, the $9 million amount, that should have been paid to the plaintiff in this case, or is your true objection the conflict of interest it creates between plaintiff's counsel and the plaintiff himself?
Our primary objection is indeed this conflict of interest, that any time you have the potential for a conflict of interest anytime there's going to be a split of the total amount payable by the defendant between attorney's fees and the class. That is why disclosure is absolutely crucial. If it's fully put out there for the class members, giving them the opportunity to either opt out or object to the settlement because they know what the class is going to get, then you have an acceptable situation.
You do not object to the concept of a contingency fee settlement in a class action suit.
Your Honor, we do not say that per se a percentage of recovery method is objectionable, but we do say that number one, it has to be fully disclosed, and number two, we believe, as suggested in the amicus brief, that there needs to be a check on that by using some lodestar analysis. In other words, we say we can start with the premise of a percentage of recovery, but then we need to go further and we need to look at the actual relief obtained and the amount of fees on an hourly basis and say, is this justifiable?
Isn't it impossible, in fact, to have any idea what the percentage is going to be until you see how the class responds?
I'm not sure I understand the question.
If 49% of the members of this class exercise their coupon rights, this settlement could be a very low percentage. If on the other hand, it was single-digit response, it could be a much higher percentage.
That's why an inflexible rule on attorney fees is not good, and this may very well be a case that by its nature is not susceptible to percentage of recovery method, but could only have attorney fees awarded on a lodestar method. And in essence, that's what the Court of Appeals was getting, and it says that because of the problem with redemption rates, even using their estimates, solely applying our legal discretion as to their estimates, not looking at the contrary evidence, there was not sufficient evidence to give an estimate of the value from which a percentage of recovery could be calculated. Now, the problem that these counsel had was that without percentage of recovery, they had no legally sufficient evidence to support any award of fees. They didn't have enough evidence to support a lodestar award because all they did was put in some affidavits which stated the bare conclusion of 6,000 hours, yet they gave no supporting time records. They admitted they kept no contemporaneous time records. They also had $500,000 in expenses that were just summarized in 12 vague categories with no supporting invoices. Fee applications in this state and elsewhere have always had to be far more detailed than that and supported by time records and actual invoices. So their dilemma was they had no way to go for a lodestar, and so they suggested the percentage of recovery method, which is completely inappropriate in a case where the amount of the recovery is so speculative. And of course, the Court of Appeals was correctly exercising the abuse of discretion standard in disregarding the evidence in favor of objectors, only looking at the evidence that they gave, the 46% estimate or the Simonson affidavit, and saying that evidence was legally insufficient as to the value of the settlement in order to calculate attorney's fees on a percentage of recovery method.
Did class counsel have a written fee agreement with the class representatives?
Your Honor, my understanding was they made the, at the fairness hearing in their brief, they made the statement that they had a, that they had the, with the original individual plaintiffs, they had a, had it on a contingent fee basis. I don't believe that they put in their contingency fee contract into the record, but I'm not positive on that.
So we don't know whether it's a 10% contingency fee or 30% or whatever.
I think they claim 33%, but I'm not sure that that's supported in the record. But that whatever they arrived at with the individual plaintiffs in no way would be or should be binding on the trial court, because its interest is to protect the hundreds of thousands of unnamed and absent class members and to make sure that the distribution of the settlement is going to be fair to all those unnamed members.
Would you still be complaining about the conflict, as you say, conflict of interest between the class members and class counsel on this failure to give notice of the amount of attorney's fees that the trial court had awarded, $75 an hour?
Yes, Your Honor, we would, because quite frankly, we
look
at the...
In other words, regardless of the amount awarded by the trial court, you still think there's a conflict?
Well, Your Honor, in certain settlements, $9.5 million could be reasonable attorney's fees as well as $75. I think you can't take the attorney's fees strictly in a vacuum. You also have to look at it in the context of the overall settlement, and it's an integral part of that overall settlement necessarily as an economic matter. I think what the bottom line in this case is about is that this court should hold as a matter of law that a settlement which is not projected to and cannot provide relief to over half the class is simply unacceptable as a matter of law. Justice Heck was asking the question, well, what if this is a low probability of success lawsuit? We think it's a good lawsuit, but granting that point, the issue is, should all of the members of the class get a small amount of relief, or can you approve a settlement that gives for a few lucky people who can afford a new truck a high amount of relief and leave over half of them out of the cold? The bottom line is that you have to have a pro rata settlement. Whatever amount of total settlement is justified, it has to be evenly distributed throughout the class, and that a settlement which causes over 300,000 people to give up all their legal rights unless they happen to be burnt to death, but gives them nothing in return, is simply unacceptable as a matter of law.
Does your position differ from that taken by the amici curiae public citizens?
I believe that we're in accord with the with public citizen on that point, Your Honor.
Let me make sure I'm clear on this. Settlement provides for $1,000 vouchers to each plaintiff truck owner. Is that correct in the class? That they're good only if they buy a new General Motors or Chevrolet truck within 15 months of the time they receive the voucher.
Correct, Your
Honor. Is that correct?
That's correct.
And evidence shows that more than 90% of plaintiff class own used trucks.
Well, Your Honor, I think more than 90% of the class own trucks which are more than 8 years old. And I think the point that Mr. Gardner was trying to make is most people are not driving a 9, 10, 12-year-old pickup truck that's worth maybe $300 or $400 or $1,000 out of choice. They'd rather be buying new pickup trucks, but they can't afford to buy them. And there was no evidence that uniquely $1,000 off would somehow enable all these thousands of people who obviously can't afford to buy a new truck to suddenly do so. In the affidavit of Mr. Simonson, which is the gentleman who did the other 49 states, he really didn't do Texas, he didn't bother to specify the reasons why the people who were not going to use the certificates were not going to use them by percentage. But he did admit in that affidavit that many of them would be because they're financially financially unable. And that's no different than the people who wouldn't qualify for a loan in Boucher. There are some people who, as a matter of finance or credit, are not going to be able to use them. And our position is that you can't leave these people out in the cold, because the settlement has to be fair, adequate, and reasonable to the majority of the class and to all the identifiable subsections of the class, including people who simply can't afford to buy a $20,000 truck, regardless of whether it's now 19 or it remains at 20.
Mr. Mandel, you've made this argument, and I know Mr. Gardner made the argument. that there ought to be a rule that more than half of the class has to get some sort of recovery. Our question, though, if recovery is a problem, and apparently all parties concede that the economic damages is what's here, and the argument made that there's been no diminution in value of the truck, and yeah, but under the DTPA, we can claim cost of repairs, so we don't have to worry about value. Question is, if a significant number, not the majority, but a significant number of members of this class have an opportunity to have some recovery, then don't the lawyers representing the class have an obligation to them to get what they can, even if it's not for a majority? Wouldn't we be here arguing this case if they refused that settlement that benefited a significant number of the class and they got a zero verdict? Haven't they breached some sort of obligation to those members?
Well, Your Honor, your question points out one of the key problems with this particular settlement, which is that this settlement was approved prior to there ever being a certification of the class. So as we sit here on this settlement today, we don't even know if the class as defined should have been a class, or whether it should have been divided up into subclasses, or whether certain people should have been left out and certain people should have been left in. And the problem is that they're willing to sacrifice the rights of over half the class without knowing whether these people properly should have been part of the class in the first place, or whether this class should have been divided up into subclasses. And once we have done the proper certification, then the argument might have some validity. But when we don't know whether these people had a good case or a bad case, whether they should have been in the class or out of the class, then a settlement that simply abandons the majority of them should not be tenable. And it points out the danger and the need for additional heightened scrutiny by the trial court on pre-certification settlements.
Any other questions?
Thank you.
The court is ready to hear rebuttal arguments.
Mr. Chief Justice, I just wanted to verify that we have 10 minutes. Counsel talked about the Boucher case. Let me cover it very quickly. Number one, Boucher was a district court judge doing what a district court is supposed to do. It was not a court of appeals decision. There is not a single court of appeals decision out there, except for the one in this case, where a court of appeals has gone back under the abuse of discretion standard and set it aside. There aren't any. Boucher was a district court judge doing what he was supposed to. Let me look at Boucher a little bit more. Number one, over 50% of the class, it was impossible for them to ever receive anything. There's no way they could qualify. IT&T was out of business. It was simply impossible for them to ever get a penny. Number two in Boucher, hold it. The response rate, it appeared there was going to be a response rate of between 1 and 3%. Boucher is totally distinguishable, but most of all, it is because it was a district court judge. It was not an appellate judge.
Justice, I want to ask you about the attorney fees issue. Can you articulate for us on public policy grounds any compelling reasons for allowing this kind of settlement in the order that it did to allow attorney's fees to be determined after the notice came out? Are there any compelling public policy reasons why that should be the order of determination?
It is accepted as public policy in many states to do it this way.
But what's the rationale behind that?
Is that the amount of settlement is separate from the attorney's fees. It is totally separate. And the settlement agreement in this case says it is separate. That's why I pointed out that GM retained three options. We could veto the entire settlement, we could object, or we could appeal.
But you recognize that there's a conflict of interest created when $9 million is awarded to a handful of plaintiff's attorneys as opposed to the class.
Yes.
You can see that there's a conflict of interest.
The potential for conflict of interest always exists in such hits of work.
Why should this court not adopt a policy that would say that in a class settlement such as this, that the attorney fees, or at least the ceiling on attorney fees, has to be a part of the notice to the class, or has to be a part of the settlement itself that sent out to the class for approval, rather than determined separately?
Judge, you would have to address the Chabay case, which is a Texas case, which approves the exact procedure that is followed here. If the attorney's fees have not been agreed to, the amount, then you send out the notice, without the attorney's fees amount being in there. That's the Chabay case. I've cited it, and it's the exact procedure that was used here.
But again, I'm looking for policy.
Okay.
Why shouldn't this court adopt a policy along those lines to flush out any conflicts of interest that might arise, such as
that
plaintiffs can make an intelligent election?
That is one course of action that this court could take. There is a good deal of law out there on this particular subject matter, and I think it would be very helpful to the court if it desires to follow that procedure.
Again, I'm just searching for the rationale behind it.
I
Can
understand.
You give us arguments on the other side?
The reason we stay away from this and the reason we back away and we don't even know about what the amount is going to be is because if we do, then we are brought in as co-conspirators, General Motors, and we're not conspiring with anybody. We retained three specific options. And so when they file their amount of attorney's fees, we have all those, all three of those options.
How many courts joined the Third Circuit in requiring a lodestar method of attorney's fee calculation for class actions?
I don't have that exact number, but there is a tremendous amount of material out there on these subjects.
Why would that be bad public policy for the state of Texas to impose such a requirement?
I think you have to look at it almost on a case-by-case basis to determine the risk involved, whether or not a contingency. You have to look at the variations in the multiple. You know, you take hours times rate, and then you add your multiplier. Different courts have gone different ways. I almost think, though, you need to do it on a case-by-case basis.
Here's the thing we can add. We can, in our opinion here, we should do nothing to clarify to the trial and appellate courts of the state what standards, if any, there are in reviewing the fairness of class actions.
No, sir, that is not what I'm saying. I'm saying I think this is a good case to clarify it. But
what clarifications would you suggest?
Well, one of them that I just mentioned was the fact that you're going to need to look at your Chabay because it would conflict. Because we've already...
Well, that was an intermediate appellate court decision that was not appealed to our court.
That is correct.
And we're certainly not bound by it.
No, not at all. It could be clarified. You would need to decide what all the other jurisdictions do and what would be the course of action most favorable for the state of Texas.
But certainly when we have the advantage of companion litigation here that involved 10 times as many drugs and 10 times as many law firms, and the attorney's fees were virtually identical, that gives us an opportunity to look at what's fair to the members of the class.
It does, Your Honor.
Isn't part of the concern that if you tell the members of the class how much the attorney's fees are going to be, that more people will object? Is that part of the concern?
I think that would be part of the concern. But, you know, the percent of objectors here was either 0.1% or 0.2%. That's 1 or 2/10 of 1%. The honest truth is, in these class action cases, most people don't object. A lot of times when you even offer money, they don't send in to get the certificates, even when they're notified. I can't tell you why. It's just that they don't do it. Class actions, there is public policy in favor of class actions. The trial judge did what he was supposed to do in this case. The problem is that the Court of Appeals tried to become super trial court judges and used the de novo review. As I said, there is not a single reported case out there in the country where an appellate court has come in and done and did what our appellate court did here.
Is there any estimate how long this case would have taken to try if the trial judge had refused the settlement?
Judge, it would have taken years on the certification issues because there would not have been an agreement that this was a certifiable class. The only certification here was for settlement purposes, and this whole matter was fraught with certification problems. For instance, there were different fuel systems from 1973 to 1991. I mean, on just fuel systems alone, there was a very valid objection. There are a whole series of objections. This may never have become a class. It could have taken years.
The trial judge doesn't the trial judge have tremendous incentives to approve whatever settlement the parties before the court agree to?
He has a duty on class actions to look at the six factors from the Ball case, and then when he has weighed all six factors, he's on the firing line to determine, does this merit my approval?
But the consequences to a trial judge who refuses a settlement will be rather profound, both in terms of the amount of time and energy the trial judge has to invest and the pressures on an already crowded docket that trial judge may have in other cases.
Could very likely be true.
And you're arguing here today that these surrounding circumstances that make this attorney fee, or these attorney fees reasonable, that there wasn't going to be any government-ordered recall, there wasn't going to be any voluntary recall on the part of General Motors. It does provide some relief to some folks who choose to avail themselves of it, and that those who might suffer injury as a result of this design defect still retain any causes of action for those injuries. Is that right? That under these circumstances, based on the possibility of losing, no class being certified except for settlement purposes, no one recovering anything down the road unless they were injured, and they still retain that right, that this is a reasonable attorney fee, settlement and attorney fee?
All of my comments were directed towards that this is a reasonable settlement. Fair, adequate, and reasonable. That's how I listed all of those factors. And when you add the attorney's fees in, this was a matter that General Motors decided did not warrant an objection.
Mr. Cook, I mean,
yes, sir.
Yes, Mr. York suggested that courts may be abandoning the lodestar approach. Can you elaborate a little bit? It seems, you know, they have applied. The question is, I guess one of the questions was, should Texas consider that? And I think Mr. York said that it just looks like it's being abandoned. Can you elaborate on that a little bit?
I don't know that it's being abandoned. It depends where you go, what is popular. I've seen the statement made, it's decided on a case-by-case basis. What some jurisdictions require that if you want a percentage recovery, that you are also required to keep your hours. In other words, normally a plaintiff's attorney does not keep hours. Some jurisdictions are saying if you have a percentage method, you must also keep hours so that we will then have an idea of what the lodestar would be.
I realize the amici brief by Public Citizen and Consumer Federation was filed less than a week ago, but as one member of the court, it would be helpful to me if petitioners chose to respond to it.
We will respond.
Are there any further questions? Thank you, counsel.
Thank you.
That concludes the argument in the first call, and the court will now take a brief recess. Pardon? We just had, the time has expired. Thank you both.